welcome to the podcast. We've got fresh content from some of the brightest minds in the Bitcoin, blockchain, and crypto space with feeds on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram that make it so incredibly easy to keep to the pulse of what's happening. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and even hit the share button to send to someone you know who would love to know about this totally free podcast. Huge thanks to our main sponsor, UnoCoin, who are not only India's leading crypto assets blockchain company, but also the reason why this podcast is available to you completely free of charge. With that said, let's jump into one of the Blockchain Impact Conference talks that took place in Toronto, Canada on December 8th, 2017. Enjoy.
I used to get a lot more effusive introductions back when I was Mint director, and then I found out that everyone wanted free samples from me. So, and you know, I want to get one question out of the way right at the very beginning. People ask me, what was my favorite thing about being Mint director? Was it taking our revenues from 2.3 billion to almost 5 billion? Was it taking us from almost dead last in the best places to work up to near the top? Was it the cutting edge of currency reform and those type of things? And I say all those pale in comparison to my dad finally giving me respect. So you need to know, I spent about two-thirds of my career in the private sector, and every time I was about to make some really big money, I would end up doing some public service because the President of the United States would ask me to give up everything, come into government, and help solve a problem. And so my parents, especially my dad, who likes to keep track of jobs because they're prestigious and they make a lot of money, was always very disappointed. So when I told him, hey Dad, I got some news for you, I'm gonna be leaving the White House soon. He said, oh, that's really great. And I said, and the President wants me to become the next director of the United States Mint. And he paused for a second and he said, finally, my son, he's gonna get a job where he makes a lot of money. I didn't have the heart to tell him that none of the money was mine. I didn't even get a discount on my own on my own products. So Sonny, thank you so much for having me here. I wanted to let you all know that I get invited to literally a couple hundred Bitcoin or blockchain or crypto conferences a year, and I only accept invitations to maybe half a dozen. And one of the reasons why I'm here today is when I take a look at all these Bitcoin conferences, many that I've been to are either US or North America and European centric. And with Sonny's background, doing all his innovative things in India, to me brings a much more global perspective. And so that's one reason why I wanted to support that. But also, many of these conferences focus on the commercial aspects or how to exploit this opportunity. And one thing that Sonny does bring to the table that's impressed me as I've kind of watched him and seen UnoCoin develop is that he has a much more global perspective. And that doesn't only mean international, but it also means that he takes into account culture and politics and commercial impact of blockchain technology. And so with that holistic view, again, I wanted to support Sonny and the things that you're doing. So thank you for inviting me here. So what's our agenda today? It's a pretty simple one, because seemingly I only have about 20 minutes and I don't want to bore you within that short amount of time, so I jammed a little bit of what I think is interesting. Beginning with, I want to explain a little bit on what perspective I'm coming from, because we all have our biases, and once you know mine, then you'll know how to interpret what my analyses are about where this industry is going. And then I want to give you this global overview of where I think Bitcoin is headed, as well as blockchain trends, and then I want to end by making some bold predictions over what I think is going to happen in this space in 2018, the year before us. So let's get started. So there you see me, a picture of myself briefing the President of the United States in the Oval Office. I had a tenure of both public and private sector service. In the public sector, I had spent some time at the White House in a very specific job. It was called, I was a special assistant to the President, which meant I functioned at about a two-star general, and I was one of the people in charge of an area called presidential personnel. And what presidential personnel does is, in the U.S. government, when a new president comes in, he gets to appoint 4,000 political appointees to head up a government of 2.5 million civil servants and military people, and eventually all those 4.5 million people report to 4,000 people. So it could be the head of OSHA, it could be a commissioner at the Securities Exchange Commission, it could be the Secretary of Treasury and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And it was my job to help the President of the United States make decisions on who should put in all those various offices. So what the byproduct is I know pretty close to 90% of government and what every single department and what every single agency does and what its chain of command is and the people who have served in those positions. So it helps give me an understanding of how government works that's different than many other people. Also, when I adopted my first daughter from China, I went to the president and said, I can't do this anymore, working 18-hour days, 7 days a week for the last 5.5 years. It kind of takes a toll, and when I'm adopting a girl, I want to spend some time being her dad. And so I want something a little bit less stressful, so I'm going to leave and try to find a job in the private sector where I could make a better living for my family. He said, I got a better idea for you. Why don't you give me a list? You've been helping me put all these people in all these top jobs. Why don't you give me a list of things that you're qualified for that would give you more of the lifestyle that you're interested in? And I gave him a list, and he called me up the next day, and he said, Eddie, you're going to become the next director of the United States Mint. And I was just kind of shocked by it. And so in that pause, the president said, this was one of the things you want to do. You're normally not quiet. So what's the issue? I said, Mr. President, when I said I needed to, starting a family, I needed to leave government to earn a better living, I meant make my own money, not the country's money. So he snorted and he said, pretty funny, just don't screw it up for me. So that's how we ended our phone call. But being the director of the United States Mint, I was in charge of making our country's currency. I reported directly to the Secretary of Treasury, so the Treasury Department I know very, very well. And my chief client is, and my only client, on the currency side was the Federal Reserve. And so I worked with the Federal Reserve very closely on their monetary policy and fiscal policy and all their monetary policies. And in addition to that, very early on, in my career, I spent time as a regulator. I was the director of the Office of Managed Care. And in America, many of our health insurance companies provide coordinated care through HMOs and preferred provider organizations. I was the entity that regulated that. So at 31 years old, I regulated a $1 trillion industry and learned the ins and outs of regulation. And so from those perspectives, I think I have a unique perspective to bring as this industry begins to grow and blossom and evolve. So that's a picture of me at a typical Mint event when I ended up one of our most successful programs was the state quarter program. And whenever we had a new coin that would come out, we would have kind of a party in that particular state and then distribute the very first quarters honoring that particular state. And typically thousands, if not tens of thousands of people would end up going to these things, which was a very exciting time, a very enjoyable time. But what it also ended up doing was giving me a deep perspective of all 50 states in America and where they were at all these various currency issues. So let's get right to the Bitcoin trends. So you might ask the question, how did a very traditional person who dealt with money in the most traditional sense evolve into a Bitcoin advocate? And I have a couple thoughts on that. First of all, even more than just a government, a public servant, one thing that drives me is ideological and philosophical and political outlooks. And so I generally only worked for Republican presidents. And the reason for that is I am a huge advocate of both the free market, democracy down to the individual, as well as decentralization. So those tend to be the core of what I believe in. And when I look at Bitcoin, my first thought when I was introduced to Bitcoin in 2011, and I was still director of the Mint, my first thought is, this is a free market alternative because the government didn't come up with this. This is a free market alternative to government's monopoly on money. So think about that. Bitcoin is a free market alternative to government's monopoly on money. So what happens in a monopoly? A monopoly ends up doing basically what it wants to do to keep its own market share. And as a result, governments go beyond just wanting to make sure that they have a functional, good, solid, accurate currency to using their power as a monopoly to begin manipulating the populace to do things that they want to do with various monetary policy. And so whether they want you to buy certain things or avoid other things or keep track of what you're spending your money on, those things end up having these huge negative political consequences on money. And so change a monopoly through competition. And what I see Bitcoin doing is offering an alternative to people that if they want to have something else to work with or migrate more strongly into something, Bitcoin allows that. The other thing that really appeals to me about Bitcoin is because of its decentralization, because of the peer-to-peer transactions, it brings the unbanked into the modern economy, which is something I care deeply about as someone interested in public policy. And so when I take a look at roughly one-third of the world population not having access to a bank, and therefore they are relegated to poverty for most of their life, Bitcoin and blockchain has the chance to break through those barriers and bring in billions of people into the modern economy. And then there are what blockchain specifically does to me is it brings more transparency to transactions, which increases trust. It brings more security to transactions going over the internet. One positive public policy aspect of that is that it can end up affirming property rights, which is extremely important. If you believe in the free market, one of the key components is that people have to be able to own things and prove that ownership. And you have problems in a lot of undeveloped countries where you could be on a piece of land for six generations and some warlord comes over and pays off some government official in order to get access to that land, and you don't know about it until you get booted off of it, or they put pressure on you to produce and then take higher taxes from you from that. So knowing that there's a chain of ownership that can't be changed unless you're willing to give up that property and deed it over to somebody else, can greatly help free markets. And I also look at this as a way to reduce the transaction and friction when you have these different types of transactions, which eventually benefit the consumers. And so those were part of my evolution from being an old money guy to being a new money guy. And that will inform you on what on my next part of what I want to talk about are the various trends that I see out there are going to be informed from those perspectives. All right, so let's go to Bitcoin trends. The obvious trend for those of us who follow this is the price of Bitcoin. So when I started putting my thoughts together earlier this week, Bitcoin was at 12,000. And right before I came, I updated it to 13,000. And then last night I saw that it broke the 17,000 mark. And that's all in 1 week. You can't help but to notice the Bitcoin price. And When I take a look at that, I'm wondering, okay, so why is Bitcoin going up? Well, the typical reason is supply and demand, right? So there's a limited supply and demand must be going up. But is it good demand? Well, we really don't know. I believe that there's a great deal of what's pushing up is speculators coming into the market. I read an article recently that even grandma is interested in Bitcoin because they're seeing the rapid rise in the increase of price, and no one wants to be left out of that. So I'm sure part of what's driving up demand is speculators beginning to come into the market. But also, there are a greater number of blockchain companies out there that want to use Bitcoin and its tokens for all its various projects, and as a result, that demand is also increasing. What I'm not seeing, though, is an increase in a number of transactions that use Bitcoin. If you take a look at what's been happening in the daily transactions, those have been very narrow in the 300,000 to 400,000 range per day. And I think at the beginning of the year, it was maybe low at around 300,000. It peaked out maybe this summer at 400,000, and it's probably back to like 350,000 transactions each day. Now, compared to cash transactions, that is a really small amount. But in Bitcoin, that's a significant volume, but that volume hasn't broken out to begin justifying the dramatic increases in the price of Bitcoin. So caution ahead. There's bound to be it going even further, but when you get this many speculators in the market, there's bound to be a correction at one time or another before solid growth begins to take place again. The other thing that is a huge trend with Bitcoin is the use of these cryptocurrency tokens as a way to raise capital for companies. I get that. I worked for a private equity company for about 8 years, and I realized the high cost of capital that come with a private equity firm, and this new field of initial coin offerings, ICOs, offers a lot of promise to raise capital for these growing companies. But to go from about 400 different types of cryptocurrencies in the last year to, in the last 12 months, up to 1,324 different types of cryptocurrencies in 2000. That was the number last Monday when I counted, which is a dramatic increase. I mean, there's not that many IPOs that are out there. And so that's one area to pay a lot of attention to because as I talk about blockchain and then future predictions, I have a couple of thoughts about what might happen to ICOs. I also, as the price of Bitcoin has increased, I mentioned even grandma's interested in investing. So as a result, there's been a resurgence in a number of Bitcoin investment funds. As you might recall, maybe about 2 years ago, there was a lot of interest there, but a lot of those companies that started up have gone by the wayside, and there was very little interest. Just this year alone, it's increased from roughly 30 companies doing various types of Bitcoin investments, where people could place money with that company and they would then invest it in all these various cryptocurrencies. There's now 90 cryptocurrency funds that have come into being in 2017 alone. Now, saying that brings it up to the amount of about 124, and total, with 124 companies, they have $2.3 billion under management. So it's relatively really small, especially when you compare it to mutual funds like Vanguard, which are multiples of thousands over the money invested in Bitcoin investment funds. And then the last area on trends is regulation. And for those of us who are in the industry, this is going to be a growing area that we need to pay more attention to. As of today, there are 10 countries that have completely banned, as much as they can ban, cryptocurrencies from being used in their countries. So the 10 countries are not in any particular order: Bolivia, Ecuador, Kyrgyzstan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Nigeria, Colombia, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Thailand. And there are other countries that have severe restrictions moving toward complete banning, like China and Russia. And then everywhere else in the world, it's a wait and see, it's legal until we say it's not attitude, including the United States. So regulation is going to be one big area to watch in the near future. So let's go to blockchain trends. So there are a number of interesting trends that I've observed, and I've talked to a lot of activity going on in this space. Number one is I think investors are going through, you know, like people go through the five stages of grief. Investors are going through several stages of investing in blockchain companies. They've gone from the first in, cutting, bleeding edge, to unrealistic expectations about how quickly this is going to grow and how much money they're going to make, to now a wait and see. We've made the investment. Let's see if this plays out before we make more investments. And so what's a byproduct of that is companies, blockchain companies, are going and transitioning from the test case and demo mode to getting more money when they can come up with a solution that can be commercialized and scaled quickly and become profitable quickly. And so there's been a lot of attention paid on that. So what does this mean for investment dollars coming in? I mentioned ICOs before. So the interesting thing for me to note is I come from a venture capital background, and so when I talk to my friends in that industry, I've seen a steady decrease in the amount of venture capital going into blockchain companies. So traditional investments like my colleague Mark Andreessen and what he's doing in his ventures, he made a lot of investments a while ago, and he's building those out. And unless it's a really unusual, interesting thing, they're not making more investments until some of these portfolio companies get a little bit more mature. So what does that mean? When you take a look at all the investments made by venture capital into the blockchain space since 2012, when blockchain became a more viable investment space, there's been about $1.1 billion that have gone in from venture capital companies. $500 million of that came in 2016. So virtually half of all the investments came in 1 year, 2016. So what's happened in 2017? Those investments have gone down to $150 million of new investments in 2016. So it's a dramatic drop from its peak 1 year ago. So venture capital companies are taking a much more wait and see attitude. Then on ICO investing, that is increasing like you wouldn't believe. Total number of ICOs, the capitalization that's gone in from that, has been $3.8 billion since 2014. So it's outpaced venture capital by four times. And of that, $3.5 billion were invested in 2017 alone. So the vast majority came in this year. So let me make a couple bold predictions. Here are my predictions for 2018. This space is going to see increased government regulations, focused mainly on Bitcoin and ICOs. And the reason why I say that is countries still have to, they have their monopoly on money. Cryptocurrencies challenge that monopoly, and so you're going to see governments beginning to focus a little more on how do we control and understand this. But then second on ICOs, with the huge number, 950 ICOs this year, and I've seen white papers, which on average are 2 to 3 pages long, double spaced. There's going to be a lot of blood in the ICO space, and when innocent investors lose their money, the government is going to get involved. And so you can expect greater scrutiny on ICOs. I think you're also going to see growth in both public and private blockchains this year. The debate in the past has been public or private, you know, decentralized versus centralized. You know, what's the purest? I think what the market is saying is there's room for both, and you're going to see both grow. So what are the opportunities for the entrepreneurs? The entrepreneurs, the opportunities are going to be that these financial institutions and corporations that are adopting these private blockchains, they're big enough where they're going to have their own in-house begin working on it. So, but where I think the opportunities are for the entrepreneurs are in mid-sized and small companies who don't have the critical mass to have their own internal team develop this, and there's going to be opportunities for entrepreneurs to fill that space. And then on public blockchain development, I think there's going to be room in the government space as well as cross-industry markets. So instead of a particular company, companies that deal with multiple companies that need some type of tracking of assets is going to open up opportunities for entrepreneurs using blockchain in multidisciplinary fields, as well as in government, which government, as big as it is, doesn't have the internal expertise and can't acquire it as quickly as the private sector can. So in conclusion, let me, because I don't even think we have time for questions and answers, but let me leave you with this thought. I'm old enough to remember the beginning of the internet and all the excitement that was around that space at that time. And then to watch it go through now several cycles before it's kind of found its way. This whole space about blockchain and cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, this all has the same feel to me as when the internet was just coming into being. And so you guys have a really special opportunity right now in that you can with the efforts and the types of projects you decide to work on will determine how this industry rolls out over the next decade and fulfills its promise to bring, to eliminate third-party trust, to bring the unbanked into the modern economy, to reduce the costs and frictions of transactions. You have a chance to make the world better. And I really envy the opportunities that you have. So that's why this conference is so important, is that to be around like-minded people, and we're all kind of groping through this, trying to figure out what that next step is, but to do it with people with the same passion and with the same commonness of purpose is really special. And so I really envy you, and I encourage you to make the most of your day here. Thank you very much for having me today.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with a friend you think would appreciate the send. Up next, more talks from past conferences. Thanks for listening.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.